Thanks everyone for being here. We're continuing in the introductory studies of the Song of Solomon, and we're steadily getting towards the end. Won't be long, I look forward to it myself, when we'll actually be able to tackle the actual song itself. And of course, these introductory studies lead up to it, to present from where we have come and our journey to get to this part where we see what's why and how Solomon decided that he would have to create from you, a young girl, well, literally without breasts, meaning prepubescent, to be able to raise her up in the way she should go, like Christ does with us, even though later in life, to be fully clothed in your word so that we can lavish you with our whole heart and mind. So we're starting a new series. It's entitled In Babylon, What Criterion Ravishes a Man or a Woman to Focus on a Prospective Mate. Part 1, a caption verse, Genesis 2, verse 18. And the Lord God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him and help meet for him." In a world devoid of the wholesale bread and water of Christ's word, these studies aim to explore the gender-specific attractions that males and females in Babylon have, which lead them to unite sexually. I say unite sexually, since increasingly Orthodox Christians never conclude that sex before marriage is an act of marriage, as seen in Deuteronomy 22, 28 to 29. And a verse here, 22, verse 16, "And if a man entice a maid that is not betrothed and lie with her, he shall surely endow her to be his wife." And surely endow means to hasten to marry or pay the price. He hastens to pay the price since he, and in the Ecclesiastes' highest likelihood, amplified his enticements, has committed fornication and is required of an elect. He swiftly acknowledges his sin before he brings his gift, his any other prayer to the altar of Christ, or before he brings his gift, his any other prayer to the altar of Christ. Matthew 5, 23 to 26, "Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest there thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily, I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence, till thou hast paid the utmost farthing." Since Eden, and reaching a peak in the 1850s to 1860s, this period is often considered the height of Victorian crisis of faith. During this time, the infamously heathen Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species, 1859, questioned the literal interpretation of Genesis. Science, already biased against the corrupt concept of an almighty God, is influenced by the generally noble scientific methodology that is a systematic empirical process for exploring observations, answering questions, and testing hypotheses to acquire knowledge while consciously aiming to debate, to delete bias. Its involvement is in making honest observations in the entire process of forming testable hypotheses, conducting experiments, analyzing data, and drawing conclusions. This iterative method is crucial for ensuring the accuracy and reproducibility of scientific research, whereas geological findings, no doubt now corrupted by Darwin, supported the concept of deep time rather than a young Earth, completely blinded by the fact that science cannot discover God. Consequently, in these apparent final decades, the decline of traditional Christianity is no longer a concern of radical intellectuals. Nevertheless, it was, as noted, a conscious phase of the human intellect, influencing both the general public and clergy alike. Beyond evolutionary theories, the higher criticism of the Bible, which involves examining it, is a historical document rather than the infallible word of God, and the emergence of atheistic prophecies, our philosophies undermined the theological foundations. The rapid expansion of industrialized cities in the 19th century disconnected many individuals from traditional ecclesiastical authority, thereby facilitating the dissemination of secular, materialistic worldviews. Despite this decline in the 19th century, was not entirely devoid of religiosity, it has also experienced evangelically rivals and the emergence of alternative religiosities such as spiritualism. As faith in a personal deity waned, many individuals in the late 19th century sought new, often secular faiths, including scientific rationalism, political socialism, or fervent nationalism. It all spawned the happy clappy Christianity, which originated in the late 1960s to 1980s, stemming from the charismatic movement and Pentecostalism as they entered mainstream churches. It is characterized by passionate worship, acoustic guitars, drums, hand clapping, and raised hands, often described in a BBC Learning English article as a 1980s term for enthusiastic Christian charismatic groups. The phrase, often used to describe churches, originated in Kansas in 1901 and spread rapidly to the UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and other nations to highlight a shift towards shallow, emotional, or superficial worship. We're all well aware that the name Babylon means confusion. By mixing, since Eden, the world has been covertly highly influenced by men and husbands unwittingly injured in their privy and stones, who imagine they are honouring women and wives by ensuring their wives' creeping authority is heard. That is C-R-E-E-P-I-N-G, creeping authority. And respected for gender equality across the social, political, economic, and mostly insidiously, the same ideologies in marriage, spiritually. She, and because of her curse in Eden, effectively has her psychological and spiritual DNA, so to speak, embedded in her heart beneath her breasts, inherently injured, determined, although confused, never to have a man, and particularly a husband, have headship over her. All for exceptionally good carnal reason, since carnal Adam couldn't only be relied upon by her to pursue her with all his heart, substituting God, and an idol is born, a signified whorish one at that. The concept of love as understood by humanity is predominantly depicted in the introductory studies. Building upon this foundation, humanity, mostly utterly unaware of the curses bestowed upon Adam and Eve, is historically, biblically rebellious, focused covertly, sexually, for its spiritual filth. Zephaniah 3:1-5. Woe to her, meaning old Israel, Jerusalem, and we while in Babylon, that is filthy and polluted, to the oppressing city. She obeyed not the voice. She received not correction. She trusted not in the Lord. She drew not near to her God. Her princes within her are roaring lions. Her judges are evening wolves. They gnaw not the bones, of course, meaning of her ideologies of self-ravishment, till the morrow. Her prophets are light and treacherous persons. Her priests have polluted the sanctuary. They have done violence to the law. The just Lord is in the midst thereof. And of course, I've got a note here for the five wise virgins sleeping with their hearts awake. He will not do iniquity. Every morning doth he bring his judgment to light. He faileth not, but the unjust knoweth no shame. From these initial unfavorable and swiftly deteriorating beginnings, rapidly advancing since the mid-18th century, stiffens humanity's inherently unruly mindset, long ago succumbed to the neglect of Judah and Babylonian Christian leaders, has dreadfully influenced young men and women in their conceptualization of love. Directly stemming from Adam's fear of loneliness, young women since Eden inherently base love on how much a young man of their focus listens to their song sensually. But in 2026, it has reached fever point. Young men, and like Adam, willfully deceived, and particularly since the internet, are mostly patently aware of women's artifice, but, and because of Adam's curse, they are stuck on the iron rails of sexual cravings, based on those chaotic longings of avoiding marital commitment, knowing it is more frequently ends in intimate and economic bitterness. In consolation, young men default to choosing whom they desire from the billions of literal and emblematic harlots to satiate their imagined rationale sexually for what they believe constitutes love. Genesis 6:1-8. And it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and the daughters were born unto them. And the sons of God saw the daughters of men, they were fair, and they took them wives of all they which they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, and the same became mighty men, which were of old men of renown. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of their thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I'll destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping thing, and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Old Israel, who today represents Babylonian Orthodox Christianity and our form of vows of marriage to Christ, insisted on singing her own song, not just for 40 years in the wilderness, but all the way to Babylon and the cross, even to this very day. Unwittingly to her, it ends with a new song, effectively a five-book succinct dirge in lamentations, causing her, the daughters of music, to be brought low. While the Song of Solomon, of course the bride knows as her husband's Song of Songs, is a celebration of Christ-centric love, union and joy, Lamentations is a collection of poems focused on grief, destruction, and the sorrowful disunity between God and his now harlot wife, Israel. As opposed to Adam and all men, Noah, the signified elect of God, listened to God instead of his own heart, not feminized by women. More directly, not defiled by the feminized Adam within. Revelation 14, 3-5, and they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders, and no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. But first, what does it mean in Genesis 2 verse 18 to be alone? Unlike the word with the Father, ironically and by design, it means that it wasn't going to be good when Adam conceived in his sinful flesh, when he would inevitably and immediately be alone again if, absurdly, chose not to listen to Eve. And understanding be alone, be means to become, fall out from Hebrews 1:83, meaning desire, covet, wait longingly, wish, sigh, want, be greedy, prefer, crave, to desire, long for, lust after, of bodily appetites. And alone means to withdraw, be separate, be idolized, an army straggler. The distinction for an elect between the solitude of being alone and the anxiety frequently produced by enduring loneliness without love elicits different emotions. However, both often evoke a sense of inconsolability. Subconsciously, solitude is the tolerable version, whereas an Adamic loneliness is the excruciating version. So, when a Christian is dedicated to marrying someone who is the closest spiritual match, he or she also has to consider the myriad personal likes and dislikes, which vastly complicates the decision. Facing the dilemma of singledom, one has to weigh whether they can live with a functional, bearable relationship rather than remain unmarried. In Babylon, faced with the stark reality of loneliness, people are going to make bad choices since they are apt to choose anyone other than the conclusive person. A substitute, while hopefully adhering to one's spiritual beliefs, is to relax one's expectations and ideals. In the focusing flush of timorous romantic intimacies, that is precisely what most of us do in the Adamic type lust of the eyes and the flesh, to settle for what we feel we can tolerate. Being alone is equated with not being chosen, that something is wrong with you, and with the carrying an unseen personality or physical deficiency or contempt, feeling that nobody, other than out of nuanced politeness, wants to be in your company is phenomenally heartbreaking condition. born alone. Whereas an elect equated with a signified Abishag-like devotion fantasized in Solomon's Shulamite creation, perceiving that God has chosen him for an infinitely higher calling than what the flesh can lust, proceeds to bear his cross of physical, psychological, and intimacy-deficient loneliness, as dreadful as it is, but in faith and hope, is made by God through his comforter, guaranteed more bearable. Both camps cry out, Psalms 34, 17 to 22. The righteous cry, the Lord heareth, and the Lord heareth, and delivereth them out of all their troubles. The Lord is nigh unto them, and they are of a broken heart, and saveth such as be of contrite spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivereth him out of them all. He keepeth all his bones, not one of them is broken. He shall slay the wicked, and they that hate the righteous shall be desolate. The Lord redeemeth the soul of his servants, and none of them that trusteth him shall be desolate. A true elect, choosy, physically and particularly spiritually about who he chooses, and gladly concedes that leaving Babylon often means being alone without one's spouse, family and friends, which is indeed a lonely affair, particularly when loneliness, as inevitably does, drags on for the rest of one's life, separated without the immediate emotional closeness of another person of the same Christ-centric mind. Even when electronic media fantastically brings everyone into the living room, still, it is not the same as physical closeness. It is all part of the emblematic cross one has to bear. Revelation 18, 4, verse 4, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. John 14, 16, and I will pray the Father, and he shall give you another comforter, that he may abide with you forever. The catalyst for the horror of becoming alone stemmed from Adam's ungovernable lust to satiate the five senses, neurologically extending to 21 senses that scientists have recently discovered, which highly amplify nuances of experience, all of which the serpent employed to arouse and deceive Eve. And they are sight or vision, hearing or audition, smell or olfaction, taste or gustation, touch or tactition. The young and beautiful Eve's visual attraction to a wide range of visually appealing material things quickly enhanced and triggered all her other four senses to eat the forbidden fruit. Similarly, Adam's sensory arousal is only that it is immensely visual, centered on Eve sensually, whereby material things become the primary means to sustain Eve's romantic appetite, to which he, too, is drawn for their mutual benefit to inevitably stroke her sentimentalities. So, too, is Christ's spiritual focus on his bride, only to stroke her spiritual appetite, and she his, as elegantly expressed in the Song of Solomon. All of those meanings of Adam's loneliness precipitate his inevitable siding with his sensually desirable lust for his beautiful wife, Eve, much preferring death with her, and his intense certitude of not wanting to be again isolated and be a straggler. Unconsciously, Adam, in unity with his wife Eve, temporarily hated his spiritual life, which fell to the ground and brought forth much physical fruit as numerous as the stars of heaven. He and Eve, representing the world, and capable of serving two masters, now serve Satan. John 12, verse 24 to 26. Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone, but if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. He that loveth his life shall lose it, and he that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal. If any man serve me, let him follow me, and where I am, there shall also my servant be. If any man serve me, him will my Father honour. Some folk may think it unfair, since although Adam is the first and the greater sinner, these studies begin with, and more notably, focus on women's reasons to engage a potential fiancé. The reason is that Eve was deceived, thereby engendering the order of God's curses and instigating the most unpalatable term, whore. Not only that, but significantly, it is the woman who, in the flesh, is a central figure in Scripture after the pattern of Christ's flesh, paradoxically becoming the new man. Christ in the new covenant now supersedes Adam's abdicated authority. and is the supreme protagonist beginning the unifying process with his wife. She now has an incredible and almost unspeakable reason to listen to and understand her husband's Song of Songs that only she can orchestrally, harmoniously sing. Although women, it seems, are better able to cope with being alone, unlike men, this certainly does not imply that women are good alone, as they too have sensual desires, most especially the desire to bear children. The father was not necessarily motivated by loneliness. He is entirely content in his perfection. However, he desired to share his perfection with creation, beginning with the Word who became Jesus Christ, his only begotten Son, in like perfection. Genesis 3:11 to 20. And he said, "Who told thee that thou wast naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldest not eat?" And the man said, "The woman that thou gavest to me to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat." And the Lord said unto the woman, "What is this that thou hast done?" And the woman said, "The serpent beguiled me, and I did eat." And the Lord said unto the serpent, "Because thou hast done this, thou art cursed above all cattle, and above every beast of the field. And upon thy belly shalt thou go, and dust shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. And I've got a note here, and that is exactly what men reap in espousal disconnectivity in servitude to women. "And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee." And then secondarily, "And unto Adam he said, Because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, Thou shalt not eat of it, curses the ground for thy sake. In sorrow thou shalt eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face thou shalt eat bread, till thou return unto the ground. For out of it thou wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt thou return. And Adam called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all living." So there you go. Gender-specific lusts are the foundation for a billion wicked thoughts. The multifaceted Babylonian females and males, cunning sensual inventions used to ensnare a partner, and by God's design, all based sexually. Unwittingly to Babylon, sporting harlotry. It all is initiated in their youth, while hormones and the newness of sexual experiences, unbridled by laws, run rampant. So, and upon that introduction, let's explore what ravishes a young man and woman to focus on a prospective mate. And a subheading here, in Babylon, what factors influence a woman's willingness to accept her ravishment by a particular man? In Babylon, and typically by these studies thus far, it's a true statement that a man spends his entire life learning how to treat a woman, and a woman spends her entire life learning how to be treated by a man, not how to treat a man. It is only Solomon's Shulamite creation that is given to know how to rightly treat a husband by Christ's design and not by her dogma. Ezekiel 33:30-33. "Also, thou son of man, the children of thy people still are talking against thee by the walls and in the doors of the houses, and speak one to another, every one to his brother, saying, Come, I pray you, and hear what it is, the word that cometh forth from the Lord. And they come unto thee as the people cometh, and they sit before thee as my people, and they hear thy words, but they will not do them. For with their mouth they show much love, but their heart goeth after their covetousness. And lo, thou art like a husband unto them, as a very lovely song of one that hath a pleasant voice and can play well on an instrument. For they hear thy words, but they do them not. And when this cometh to pass, lo, it will come, then shall they know that a prophet has been among them." Of course, their current grand finale, final statements always is, The Shulamite in the Song of Solomon hears her husband's pleasant voice, always eager to ravish him, and she, the final daughter of music, gladly sings and dances to his tune, since she becomes the prophet as he is. Eve, representing all women, is first to receive her curse, even though Adam is the greatest sinner in virtually selling his wife into harlotry. She loves sensuality, pretty things, that all, and broadly speaking, the five senses extended to 21 senses to find opportunities to maximize their value. Adam is the same. It needs Eve's wonderfully natural, therapeutic, ravishing responses as a young woman to vastly amplify his. From those standpoints, incredibly biased towards their gender-specific curses for selfish advantage is the foundation of what ravishes them individually. Regarding both believing and unbelieving Babylonian women, the fundamental principles that allure and captivate her into accepting a man involves a synthesis of emotional, social, and psychological factors. With Orthodox Christian women, his desirability is markedly variable, contingent upon the levels of belief and faith they share in their mutually acknowledged Jesus. Women are primarily drawn to men who display confidence, emotional intelligence, reliability, and kindness. Here are the universal agreed upon key principles and traits biblically corresponding that make a Babylonian man desirable to a Babylonian woman. One, and they're generally considered as the three A's, attraction or adoration, attraction, adoration, and admiration. For a woman to commit, she needs these three pillars. Attraction, meaning physical. There must be a classic or basic physical attraction to start. Adoration, women need to feel valued and special. A man who shows he thinks she is worth the effort to keep, effort keeps her captivated. Admiration, a woman must admire her partner's attraction, actions, character, or skills, not just be admired by him. Number two, emotional intelligence and stability. Emotional safety, the ability to be vulnerable without punishment. A man who creates a safe space for feelings fosters trust. Kindness and empathy are consistently shown through actions, not just words, which is a major factor in long-term attraction. Consistency, a man who does what he says he will do, allowing her to rely on him. And number three, confidence and masculine presence, unshakable confidence. Not arrogant, but comfortable with oneself, able to make decisions and not desperately trying to impress. Initiative, taking charge of planning dates or solving problems, showing headship and reduces the burden for her. Purpose and ambition, meaning having a passion for life and goals outside the relationship, shows direction. Number four, integrity and trustworthiness. Of course, remembering that this is all in Babylon, that meaning being a man of principle, integrity, is at the top of the list. A woman honours a man who honours himself by living by his own set of values, and an Orthodox Christian, a personalised selection of Christ's values. Transparency. Liars are not trusted, and without trust, no long-term relationship can be built. And then there is number five, respect. Respecting her autonomy. A woman wants a partner who views her as an equal and supports her career, passion, and personal goals. Respect of others. How a man treats others, service, staff, strangers, is a major indicator of his character. And of course, the summary of that, as seen in by the internet in 2025 to 2026, recent studies of that period indicate a shift in which kindness and humour are often valued more highly than status or financial means alone, though these remain important for security. Figured as social intelligence, meaning the ability to handle social situations and show humour. Maturity, emotional stability and capacity for a serious relationship. Good hygiene, taking care of oneself, shows respect for oneself and the partner. And that concludes just the initial part, and next week, Lord willing, we'll elaborate on how women in Babylon utilise those five aspects employed in mate selection. And then after that, we'll move on to how men do the same by their criteria. Thank you again for everyone being here.